I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In 2018, Missouri voters made medical marijuana legal. Since then, the state has issued licenses to 192 dispensaries and has already begun accepting applications from residents hoping to be eligible for cannabis treatment. Today, learn about the process to secure a medical marijuana ID and what having one will allow you to do. We'll find out how the state plans to monitor the program to prevent abuse and wrongful use. Then, the deliberate laws and policies that led to segregated cities in America. We'll hear what role the federal government played and learn the lingering effects of decades-long racist housing policies. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services has awarded licenses to 192 medical marijuana dispensaries throughout the state. That was the minimum number provided for by a new constitutional amendment on medical marijuana that Missouri voters approved in 2018. Question is, how will Missouri get medical marijuana to people who need it, and how will the state keep it away from those who don't? Now, a conversation with the state's new medical marijuana czar about how all this is going to work. With us, Lendell Fraker is Director of Medical Marijuana in Missouri. He's a former state representative. Lendell, nice to have you. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. Appreciate your time. And how many Missourians have successfully applied for and received these new medical marijuana cards? What can you tell us about that?
Sure. Since June the 28th of last year, we have now received, we've approved 33,490 patients and 921 caregivers. So around 34,000 patients have been approved for a card.
Any sense, was that the number you expected, Lindahl, or is that more or less?
Well, that's a good question. And the reason the drafters of the amendment and the industry leaders had told us back when we took this program on that we should expect a 2-3% adoption rate of the state's population, which would be somewhere average of about 150,000 patients within the first 3 years. So that's kind of what the program was designed and built upon. We also had a MU market study done back about last April, and the MU market study thought we would have about 26,000 patients after 3 years. Hmm. So we certainly have surpassed that after about 7 months, and we believe the 150,000 average or 2-3% adoption probably is going to be pretty accurate.
Okay. I'm wondering, I guess for a lot of folks, this is the big question, what do we know as to when people, residents of Missouri who have been approved here will be able to get to dispensaries that have been awarded licenses to actually pick up a supply of medical marijuana?
Sure. We anticipate some dispensaries possibly being ready to go maybe early summer. The licensing process is all complete now as far as issuing licenses, but we have to begin our commencement and orientation walkthroughs, which will begin in March. And so there could be some cultivation facilities possibly ready to go in March, and then it'll take about a 90-day or 120-day growth period somewhere between there to get the product up and running and ready to go back on to the dispensaries. So I think June would be possibly the earliest we could see any dispensaries open up.
So you're suggesting that the state has to do inspections of these dispensaries before they actually go online and open for business?
Absolutely. Both the cultivation, manufacturing facilities, and then also the dispensaries will have to make sure they all fulfill their obligation as they applied through the application process.
The state has awarded 192 licenses to dispensaries around the state, as I mentioned in the opening. There's some thinking that you will eventually award more. Is that how likely a possibility is that, Lendell?
Well, of course, it'll all depend on supply and demand. And that's kind of the way this amendment was drafted. You know, it said that we should issue at least the minimum prescribed amounts, which we have done that. And then based on the needs of the patients in Missouri, then we could see whether we need to issue more or not to make sure the patients have easy and affordable access.
Lindahl Fraker is my guest. He's director of medical marijuana in Missouri, former state representative. If you have questions for Lindahl about how this program is going to work or what's involved in actually getting access to medical marijuana in Missouri, your questions are welcome. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, what makes medical marijuana different from recreational marijuana?
Well, the products are the same, so there's really no difference in them. It's just the way the programs are administered and regulated in the states where they, you know, where they are.
Is there a difference in the THC component that might be a factor here? Because THC is the ingredient that makes people feel high. Isn't the THC component in the medical marijuana going to be a little bit lower than what I might be able to buy on the street?
Actually, that's not really specified in the amendment or in the Constitution as voted on by the voters. What it said was is that upon doctor certification, if a doctor certifies that you have one of the various diagnoses that's mentioned in the Constitution, then you could be certified to have medical marijuana for that diagnosis, and the certification allows you to have up to 4 ounces per 30 days. And there is an exception to that if the need would be for more, then a second physician has to certify and give an opinion, but then they could have up to 8 ounces. And then that 8 ounces or 4 ounces, I should say, would roll into grams and other types of products besides flowering products. But there's no specificity of a THC content.
Who decided on the 4 ounce a month limit? And again, you said you can get more if it's needed, but why 4 ounces? Why not 6 or 8 or 2?
It's a good question, but that's what was in the amendment and is now part of amendment of Article 14 of our Constitution.
Yeah. And people will be allowed to grow medical marijuana on their own, right? And that also is part of the amendment?
That's correct. Yes. If they purchase a home cultivation card, then they can do what they call home cultivate, and it will allow them to grow up to 6 flowering plants at home. Or they could also have a caregiver do that for them. And a caregiver can actually serve 3 patients.
What's that license cost, Lindahl?
It's a...
Are you there, Lindahl? Back
here? Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're back. I'm glad to have you back. Yeah, we were talking about medical growing it at your home and how that happens.
For $100 home cultivation card, then you can cultivate at home, or you can have a caregiver do that for you for the same $100 card, caregiver home cultivation card, and then the patient card is $25 that you would actually renew annually if you want to be a patient.
And again, you said, I think you can grow, 6 plants at a time?
6 flowering plants at a time. That's correct. And the caregivers can do up to 3 patients if they want to work for 3 patients.
How much marijuana will 6 flowering plants yield? Any feel for that?
I do not really have that information readily available. They tell me that it should be plenty for one patient, though, is what I've been told.
Yeah, okay. So if you qualify to get a medical marijuana card, but maybe for how do you qualify? If someone's interested in getting one, what do you need to do? I think we lost you again. Let's take a short break here. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And welcome back, and our apologies for the technical breakdown here. Need something to spice up your inbox? I've just got the thing. Go to kcur.org/Kraske right now and subscribe to Kraske Off Mic. You'll get updates on the shows you missed and a weekly column from yours truly. Sign up now at kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow, hear from Mayor Quentin Lucas himself about Kansas City's top budget priorities. There's problems like potholes, affordable housing, and free bus fares. But how's he going to pay for it all? We'll ask the mayor tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Richard Rothstein wants to make a point about why American cities came to be as segregated as they are. The point is this: our cities are racially divided because of a longstanding and very intentional effort to divide white citizens from black citizens. This was a determined effort and not some random set of racist policies that hinged on individual prejudices and income differences. The federal government itself was up to its neck in creating policies that led to segregated public housing and the demolition of previously integrated neighborhoods. Our suburbs grew with the help of federal subsidies that hinged on understandings that no homes would be sold to African Americans. These new standards were upheld through support of police and prosecutors who enforced sometimes violent resistance to black families in white neighborhoods. Richard Rothstein tells us this story in his 2017 book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. He speaks about this at 7:30 p.m. Tuesday, that's next week, at Arupe Hall Auditorium over at Rockhurst University. Richard Rothstein, welcome to Up to Date. So good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
You say that imposition of the segregation in where black and white people lived was intentional and deliberate. And I'm wondering, how do you know that?
The historical record is quite clear about it, and this is not the first time it's been written about. When I wrote my book documenting the role that the federal government had in requiring racial segregation in every metropolitan area of this country, I was able to rely on a lot of previously published work. The subtitle of the book is A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. It hasn't been hidden. The federal government, for example, began the nation's civilian public housing program in the 1930s by building segregated housing, separate projects for African Americans, separate projects for whites. Most projects were for whites, as you said a minute ago, frequently segregating neighborhoods that weren't segregated before. The federal government, as you mentioned, subsidized the suburbanization of this country by guaranteeing bank loans for developers to build subdivisions primarily for working-class families, middle-class families, on condition that no homes be sold to African-Americans. In fact, the federal government often required that these developers place clauses in the deeds of every home prohibiting resale to African-Americans or rental to African-Americans. As you mentioned, in many, many instances, mob violence that was frequently protected by the police, sometimes even organized by the police, drove African Americans out of homes that they legitimately purchased in white neighborhoods.
You know, this notion that the federal government was so intricately involved in this segregation that you're describing is going to really surprise people. And I think one thing I struggle with is this idea that we have presidents of this country, we have senators, we have members of the House of Representatives, we have governors, people all in the business of looking out for the welfare of their citizens. How could it come to pass that no one stepped in and stopped this practice while it was being carried out in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s?
Well, this country has never really dealt with the legacies of slavery and even of Jim Crow. It shouldn't surprise you that the government pursued these policies when it comes to residential segregation. As we know, school segregation was considered legal by the Supreme Court up until 1954. So this was a period of American history when we had a caste system, a legacy of slavery. Whites typically, even in the Democratic Party, even in the Roosevelt administration, the New Deal, had an attitude that African Americans were less entitled to the benefits of citizenship than whites, and they pursued policies that was consistent with that view.
Again, this is going to rock some people's world because you're describing policies that were in place at the time of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who is widely heralded as one of our greatest presidents, Richard.
Well, let me tell you a story about Franklin Roosevelt. In 1913, Woodrow Wilson was elected president of the United States. He was the first Southerner to be elected president of the Democratic Party since the Civil War. He embarked on a program to segregate the federal civil service. The federal civil service had been integrated up to that point. Blacks and whites worked together in federal office buildings in Washington. The policy to segregate the federal service required placing curtains in federal office buildings that separated African Americans from whites. It required firing African Americans in the civil service who were in supervisory positions because it was no longer permitted for blacks to supervise whites. It required the construction of separate washing facilities for African Americans and whites. Well, one of the largest departments of the federal government at that time in the 1910s was the Navy Department. The Assistant Secretary of the Navy, who was responsible for implementing this policy of segregation, was Franklin Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not suggesting this was Roosevelt's idea, but it was part of the environment of the Democratic Party in which he matured, in which he grew up, and which he assumed was natural when he was president. Let me say this. African Americans in 1932 did not vote for Roosevelt on a whole. They voted for Herbert Hoover because traditionally African Americans supported the Republican Party, not the Democratic Party, because of its history of Abraham Lincoln and Reconstruction and the Civil War. But in 1936, they switched. In 1936, African Americans suddenly overwhelmingly voted for Democrats. And they voted for Democrats because the first time they got federal benefits. They were segregated benefits, but many African Americans thought that segregated benefits were better than no benefits at all. And so that's why we have this myth about the progressivism of the Democratic Party on issues of race. They provided benefits for African Americans for the first time, but on a segregated basis, and the consequences of those policies are enormous in today's inequality.
Yeah. You know, one thing I wondered is the extent to which these segregated housing policies, that's our main focus here today, are still around even now. Because in the Kansas City area, like so many communities across the country, there remains any number of examples of suburbs that remain largely white only.
Yes, these policies were so powerful in the mid-20th century that they pretty much determined the racial landscape that we still have today. For example, I mentioned a minute ago the suburbanization of the country. After World War II, the federal government financed suburbs for returning war veterans on a whites-only basis, prohibiting African Americans from moving into them, from purchasing homes in these suburbs. They were inexpensive homes. These were for returning war veterans, working-class men who had jobs in the post-war economy. Typical homes were 750 square feet. They sold in the late 1940s for $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 at the most. In today's money, that's about $100,000. Today, those homes no longer sell for $100,000, as you well know. In some parts of the country, they're $1 million. In most parts, it's $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. Those suburban homes are now unaffordable to working-class families of either race.
Right.
So the white families who bought those homes for $100,000 in today's money gained over the next few generations wealth from the appreciation and the value of their homes. They used that wealth, that equity, to finance their children's college educations, to subsidize their retirements, maybe to take care of temporary emergencies, and to bequeath wealth to their children and grandchildren who then had down payments for their own homes. African Americans who were prohibited from participating in this wealth-generating policy gained no such wealth. Today, African-American incomes, on average, are about 60% of white incomes. But African-American wealth is only about 7% of white wealth. And that enormous disparity between a 60% income ratio and a 7% wealth ratio is almost entirely attributable to unconstitutional federal housing policy that was practiced in the mid-20th century that determines much of the racial inequality that we have today.
That disparity is just absolutely staggering to me. That should be plastered on billboards all over every community so people begin to understand.
Well, I agree. It's an enormous disparity. It's attributable to housing policy practiced by the federal government. We have this myth of de facto segregation, that the reason we continue to be segregated is because people's self-choices and private discrimination.
And what you're describing is something very different than that.
Yes, of course there was private discrimination and bigotry. Of course, even federal officials were responding to policies that were popularly demanded by many white citizens. But the Constitution doesn't permit federal officials to bow to private discrimination or private prejudice. It's a civil rights violation. The Constitution requires the federal government to stand up to bigotry, not to reinforce it. So this myth of de facto segregation has no basis in reality. It's something we tell ourselves to excuse ourselves from confronting the unconstitutional nature of our racial boundaries and our obligation to do something about it.
So to what extent, and maybe this may not be your kettle of fish here, maybe it's somebody else's research, but to what extent are we still steering Americans into housing based on the color of their skin today? Do we know the answer to that question?
Yes, we do, in large part. Partly, of course, it's because of the economic differences that were created that I've described, and you don't need to steer people if you've created a prior situation in which whites have wealth and African Americans don't. But there are also ongoing policies that we follow that reinforce segregation. For example, the federal government now has a program to subsidize housing for low-income families who are disproportionately minority. It's called the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit. Program run by the Treasury Department. The U.S. Treasury Department gives tax credits for developers to build housing that's affordable for lower-income families. The Treasury Department regulations place a priority on placing those low-income housing developments in already low-income neighborhoods, reinforcing their segregation. We have another program called the Section 8 program, vernacularly, or your listeners may be familiar with that term. Mm-hmm. It's a subsidy that's given to families who can't afford to pay rent in a market where rents are too high. That program also reinforces segregation because many all-white communities don't permit Section 8 vouchers to be used in them. One reason is that they have zoning ordinances now that prohibit the construction of apartments or townhouses or even garden apartments, not things that would destroy the character of the community, but these suburbs keep lower-income families out with these kinds of zoning rules. We have other policies that also reinforce segregation. The Trump administration is rolling back rules that will allow those policies to be challenged. In many places, for example, African Americans are paying property taxes at higher rates than whites, higher effective rates than whites, because assessments are not kept up to date. Property assessments are not kept up to date. And so if white properties appreciate at a faster rate than black properties do, which happens in many, many cities in this country,
right,
and the assessments aren't kept up to date, the result is that African Americans pay an unfairly high right. property tax compared to whites.
Richard Rothstein is my guest. He's a scholar. His 2017 book is titled The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. We're talking about segregated housing patterns in this country and how they came to be. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So you say the federal government pursued two important policies in the mid-20th century or so that resulted in segregated metropolitan areas. Let's talk about these. One policy involved demolishing integrated neighborhoods to create segregated public housing. Tell us about that one.
Sure. This will surprise many people, but we had a lot more urban working class integration in the mid-early 20th century than we have today. We'd be stunned if we were transported back there to see the extent to which it existed. It existed for the simple reason that we were a manufacturing economy. No internet, no tech world. We were a manufacturing economy, and factories had to be located near deep water ports or near railroad terminals to get their parts and ship their final products. So if you had a factory district that was employing both African Americans and whites, they had to live in roughly the same neighborhoods near that factory district. They had to be able to walk to work or take short streetcar rides. People didn't have automobiles to drive in from the suburbs. The federal government frequently, when it built housing for workers, public housing, demolished that integrated housing and built segregated housing in its place, creating patterns of segregation that hadn't previously existed.
And the neighborhoods were demolished, Richard, because they had been integrated?
No, they were demolished. They were integrated housing that was demolished to make space to clear land for public housing that was segregated. So the housing created a segregated pattern. The great African-American novelist, playwright Langston Hughes, described in his autobiography how he grew up in an integrated downtown Cleveland neighborhood. We don't think of downtown Cleveland as being an integrated place today. But he says his best friend in high school was Polish. He says he dated a Jewish girl in high school. Mm. It's what we would expect to happen in an integrated neighborhood. In Cleveland, the Public Works Administration, the first New Deal agency, demolished housing in that neighborhood and created two separate projects, one for blacks and one for whites, creating a pattern of segregation that hadn't previously existed. And this took place all over the country. In my book, The Color of Law, I like to talk about self-satisfied smug places that think they're better than other people. Cambridge, Massachusetts, place that many of your listeners may be familiar with, the area between Harvard and MIT, the Central Square neighborhood, was an integrated neighborhood in the 1930s, about half black and half white. The Public Works Administration demolished housing there. The federal government built separate projects for blacks and whites, creating a pattern of segregation in the Boston metropolitan area. With that and other projects that persist to this day.
Would you tell people about this history and the federal government's culpability here? Do people sometimes not believe you?
Well, I think their reaction is, how come I didn't know this?
Yes,
sure. How come I didn't learn this in school? And one of the things I talk about in my book is the way in which high school textbooks continue to lie about this history. But people don't disbelieve it because nobody has challenged a single factual description in this book. I'm not a professional historian, but no historian has challenged a single fact in this book, so it's hard for people to not believe it. They just are surprised that they didn't know it before because it is so well established in fact.
The book, again, is The Color of Law, L-A-W, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. The second policy that you describe in this book involved subsidizing the construction of suburbs, but only on the condition that houses there be sold to white families. We saw a lot of this in Kansas City. In addition, deeds were written up that prohibited sale to African Americans. Explain this one to us.
Well, this was not a policy of rogue bureaucrats in the federal government. It was written out in the federal policy manual that was distributed to appraisers all over the country, whose job it was to evaluate the applications of developers for federal bank guarantees to build their developments. In the mid-20th century, particularly, although not starting, but particularly in the period after World War II, these developers could never have assembled the capital to build thousands of homes and giant subdivisions that occur everywhere in the country. No bank would be crazy enough to lend them the money to build these homes. The only way they could get the money to build these homes, to buy the land and to build the homes, was to go to the Federal Housing Administration, apply for a bank guarantee, and get that bank guarantee on condition that they never sell a home to an African American. As I said before, this is not the action of rogue bureaucrats in the federal government. The underwriting manual not only prohibited bank guarantees for loans to developers who would create integrated developments, the manual even required that no guarantee be given to a developer of a subdivision that might be all white, but that was located near where African Americans were living, because in the words of the written federal manual, that would run the risk of infiltration of inharmonious racial groups. Mm-hmm. This is what the federal manual said. So this was a written policy of the federal government that began in the 1930s and continued really until 1950 or so.
You know, one of the best examples of this is Levittown. Am I saying that right? Built just east of New York City. What did the federal government do here to ensure that this suburb got built? Because it's exactly what you just described.
Yes, well, it is exactly what I just described. William Levitt, the builder of this development, was a bigot. There's no question about it. He would not, if he was left to his own devices, he would not have sold homes to African Americans. He said as much. But he wasn't left to his own devices. If the federal government had guaranteed his bank loans on condition that he only sell homes on a non-discriminatory basis, he would have had no choice but to do so because it was the only way he would have been able to build that subdivision. there would have been some bigoted whites who wouldn't want to move to a integrated development. But the housing shortage for returning war veterans when that subdivision was built, 17,000 homes in one place, the housing shortage was so enormous that for any bigoted white family that didn't want to move into an integrated development, there were 10 waiting online to take its place.
Wow.
So but for the federal policy that required segregation of that and subdivisions all over the country in every metropolitan area, but for the federal policy, we would not have the segregation in this country that we have today.
Let's go to some phone calls. 816-235-2888 is the phone number. Tweet us at KCUR up to date. Vince from Waldo, you're on with Richard Rothstein. Good morning.
All right, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to say quickly, I'm glad that he mentioned the caste system, because along with that, what most white folks don't understand is the intentionality of racism. The caste system was able to do that because those that were in power created systems so that it would not make them look like the victim, because the systems were already in place to discriminate. And so that was my major point, is the intentionality of racism.
Okay. Vince, I'm glad you called. Thanks very much. Let's go to Ian from Bonner Springs. Ian, you're on the air.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for taking my call. My dad's actually from Levittown, PA. It's funny you bring that up. But my question is, in light of the lack of understanding about this subject, what organizations exist that are trying to spread awareness and education on this subject, and how can we support them?
Well, that's a great question. Richard, what do you know about that?
Well, there are some organizations that are doing it. There are many organizations also that are working on the issue of affordable housing, because we have an enormous housing crisis today that affects not only African Americans, but whites as well. Affordable housing is not the same as non-segregated housing. It's part of the problem, but it's not the entire one. But I would mention for support the National Fair Housing Alliance, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, as groups that are working to challenge this. There's a research group in Washington called the Poverty and Race Research Action Council that's working on this. There's a group based in Kansas City calling for a national homes guarantee that's working on this issue of affordable housing for all people. So there are groups, but we need more. We need a new national civil rights movement that's going to demand a remedy for the civil rights violations that created this segregation. I'm hoping to see such a new civil rights movement emerge.
What kind of remedies would you have in mind, Richard, if you were the ruler of the world? What would you impose?
Well, I'm not the ruler of the world, and no ruler of the world would be able to remedy this without popular support. So The most important thing we need to do is to educate the American people about their constitutional obligation to remedy this civil rights violation. We, for example, I mentioned some of these a minute ago, we need to prohibit zoning ordinances that prohibit the zoning ordinances that prohibit the construction of anything but single-family homes on large lot sizes in exclusive white suburbs. That's a big bar to solving this problem.
And why is that a part of the answer here?
Because we cannot desegregate this country if we maintain all white suburbs based on economic considerations. There's nothing that's incompatible with the character of a residential community, from having townhouses or garden apartments, other architecture that fits in with the community but that permits people of moderate incomes to live there. That's an essential requirement. We should also be subsidizing African Americans to buy homes in communities that they were once excluded from when these communities were affordable and then are now unaffordable. And there are proposals for down payment assistance for people who've lived in historically segregated low-income communities that won't get passed without public support. Mm-hmm. I mentioned some programs before that reinforce segregation by effectively requiring that low-income housing be placed in existing low-income communities. Mm-hmm. So those are the kinds of policies that we need to pursue.
I gather you think that the public support you just mentioned may not be there yet?
No, it is not there yet, but it's growing. We are having, I think, a more accurate and passionate discussion today in this country about the legacies of slavery and Jim Crow than we ever have before in American history. It really started with the killing of the young man Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. It's taken off from there. There are many books that are now popular on this topic. Mine isn't the only one. Mm-hmm. There's Michelle Alexander's book about the new Jim Crow. There's Matthew Desmond's book, Evicted. There's Brian Stevenson's book, Just Mercy. There's the work of Ta-Nehisi Coates, which has become wildly popular. So we are having a very accurate and passionate discussion about it. It hasn't yet led to the kind of action that we need to remedy this, but this kind of discussion is a first step.
Let's go back to some calls at 816-235-2888. We're talking with Richard Rothstein about why this country is so segregated. 816-235-2888. Bill from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. Steve, Bill Timaeus here. I just wanted to make the point that local governments also contributed to the discriminatory housing patterns. When I was at the Star in the mid-70s, I wrote a series of articles, for instance, that showed that we had redlined 50 square miles of Kansas City's inner city.
Right.
The school district was making decisions about moving or not moving people that led to housing pattern changes. There were decisions about construction of the Bruce Watkins Freeway that threw people out of neighborhoods and resegregated neighborhoods. So it was, as much as the federal government is at blame here, there was also local decisions that contributed to this.
Bill, it's always good to hear from you. I'm glad you called. Thanks very much.
Beth, thanks.
Patricia from Lee Summit. Patricia, you're on Up to Date.
Hey, thanks for my call. I just wanted to comment. I grew up in Willingboro, which is a Levitt town in South Jersey, and it was just ironic that when I grew up in the 60s, the town was about 30% African-American, and now it's about 90% African-American, which is interesting considering Levitt's red line policies.
Hmm. Interesting. Thanks for calling, Patricia. Appreciate that, too.
All right.
You know, I was struck in the book, you even talk about the federal government resisting efforts to build integrated housing when developers approach them with that idea. You tell a story about one of my heroes, the great American writer Wallace Stegner out in California at Stanford, who tried and failed to get the government's backing for an integrated housing project. What happened to Wallace Stegner?
That's a terrific story. Wallace Stegner, also a great hero of mine, his book, Angle of Repose, yes, is a classic.
Mm-hmm.
But before he wrote that, prior to World War II, he had written an autobiography, which got him some attention. And after World War II, Stanford offered him a position teaching writing. In those days, college professors were paid modestly, like other middle-class workers. And he got out to Stanford and found there was no housing available. We had enormous housing shortages, I mentioned earlier, after World War II. So Wallace Stegner assembled and worked with a group of other middle-class workers, not only college professors, but high school teachers, electricians, postmen, and they formed a cooperative. And the cooperative got together, pooled their money, and bought a tract of land right outside Stanford University and planned to build 400 homes on this large track, a large ranch that they had purchased. They applied to a bank for a loan. Nobody would give them a loan because the federal government would not approve a loan for the construction of these homes because of the 100 members of this cooperative that he had created and participated in and led. Three were African American. And unless those three were expelled from the cooperative, the Federal Housing Administration would not guarantee the bank loans to this co-op.
Yeah.
Eventually, they had to disband the co-op. They sold it to a private developer. They sold the land to a private developer who excluded African Americans and on that basis was able to get FHA financing to build a development outside Stanford University.
Hmm. You know, based on your own experience, do the federal officials today that you deal with understand this history, Richard, and do they know the impact this history has had on generations of African Americans?
Well, federal officials today in the Trump administration, I really don't know. Certainly, many federal officials do understand this history. The willingness to do something about it is different from understanding the history. And as I've said, I think that understanding the history is a first step. But the solutions to this problem are not supportable without public support. For example, Secretary of HUD.
I got like 30 seconds here. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Secretary of HUD Ben Carson came into office denouncing the zoning ordinances in suburbs that permit only single-family homes. He now has backed off that position and says those kinds of ordinances are okay.
Hmm. Well, Richard Rothstein's book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America, he speaks about all this at 7:30 next Tuesday evening on the campus of Rockhurst University. More information on the Rockhurst website. Richard, what an eye-opening, interesting conversation. I sure appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you. Tomorrow on the show, we'll explore one sexual assault survivor's road to recovery and why she contacted her attacker 14 years later. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Angstrom. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.